Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast. I'm John Calloway.
And I'm Clayton Hunt.
And with us today, we have David Haney. David works at Stack Overflow as an engineering manager. He's a craft beer enthusiast and loves supporting local breweries and watching movies in old school one screen theaters with his lovely wife. Welcome, David.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, David, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started in the industry?
That's kind of a long story. I'll try and give you the shorter version of it. I probably was destined for programming and technology since the ripe age of 3 or 4 years old. My father, back in the day, this would have been 1986, 87, when computers were very uncommon in households and you had to use modems to get to the so-called internet, which didn't really exist at that point en masse for another couple of years. And they were also very expensive at that time. Having a home PC was $4,000 or $5,000 pretty easily. And my father happened to have one for his work because he worked, we grew up in Canada. I'm from Calgary, Canada. I'm an immigrant to the United States. And up there in Calgary, you tend to work in the oil field. And he did that for a while. And then he kind of worked through the ranks to become an oil and gas software person working on terminals and mainframes and stuff initially. So I always had a computer in the house. It was a Macintosh 80, I think is what it was called, Mac 80. It's like an 80 megabyte hard drive, tiny little thing I used to call the trash and tosh. It had a black and white screen, had a couple games on it that I played. Then he used it for his job, of course. And I think that is where it started. That got me curious about programming as I kind of started to use the thing and get a bit older and understand it more and more. I wanted to, I'm an inquisitive person. I wanted to understand why things worked, not just how they worked. And so I started to play with different kinds of debuggers and code dumpers, runtime binary dumpers, that sort of thing, back in the day, probably when I was about 10 years old. And then from there, it just sort of, I was a typical nerd in school. Ironically, now, if you don't have a phone and computer, you're a nerd. But back then, if you had a computer, you were a nerd. So I definitely fit the profile. I was picked on in school, wasn't that cool or anything, but who is really? And definitely, progressed through high school, took computer courses, got out of high school and figured out, that I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I sure liked computers. And so I went to university for computer science, which took me a long time because I'm not a good student. I'm really bad at learning by reading. I'm really good at learning by doing, which makes me more applicable to the trades, I guess. But it took me 6.5 years to get my 4-year degree. It was painful. I did really badly. I failed a couple courses. I started in 2002. I got out in 2008. And then I jumped into the recession, which was a good time for everybody involved, particularly if you lived in Calgary, Alberta, which is kind of the oil capital of North America in a lot of ways. And well, Texas debatably is too, but at least it's the Canadian one. And job pickings were slim. It was a tough time. It took me a couple months, but I managed to get on with an oil and gas company. And then my career just sort of went from that company to another oil and gas company. And I picked up skills in .NET and Java and actually DB2. One of them was using DB2. Good times.
Nice.
And SQL 7. And then from there, eventually moved down to America and continued down a career path and trajectory that has landed me somehow here.
So how do you end up at Stack Overflow?
That's a really good question. I had a job probably about 4 years ago now, in 2013, with a local startup that I will not name. But if you were a sleuth and went on to stalk me on the internet and found my LinkedIn profile, you could probably do the math. It was not a terrible place to work, but it was not a particularly exciting or enjoyable place. And I had kind of been bait and switch, which I think a lot of people in programming and in IT have been at one point or another. And that means that you're promised a certain kind of job and things you'll be doing, and then you just totally end up doing something completely different. And In this case, I was hired as the architect, systems and software architect, who would create this new point of sale system for mobile apps so that you could kind of do transactions on your phone using Apple Pay and stuff like that. And instead, I was basically just the zombie typewriter of the owner, who was very much in control of the whole thing. And when people, during that time when I worked there for about 9 months, people would ask me, what do you do for a living? And I said, well, if you took my hands and you chopped them off and put them on sticks and handed them to my boss, that's kind of what I do. And he, I'm sure if he's listening, he doesn't appreciate that, but we're friends now, so it's probably fine. Anyway, I was not enjoying my job after a while. It got to a point where I was pretty frustrated. And I was on Stack Overflow, as many developer types often are, throughout my workday, trying to get answers to some of the problems I was having at work. And I saw an ad on the corner of the screen, which was that they were hiring and apply. And so I did. I was like, well, what have I got to lose? You know, if you don't take a shot, you automatically rejected. And the worst thing they can do is reject you anyway. So I sent in a very snarky cover letter that basically cataloged my entire history of failures. Which is important, I think. It kind of shows perspective and shows you that I'm not, at least these days, an egomaniac, though there probably was a period of time where I was. Long story short, I didn't hear anything from them for months, and I figured, oh, I just didn't make the cut. And then that job sort of built up to a point where I just couldn't do it anymore. And I came home one day really depressed, and my wife said, just quit. Like, you've got some savings, just quit, you'll find something. So I came in the next day and I quit, and I was walking out to my car to go home when my phone rang, and it was Stack Overflow. And they said, hey, really sorry it took us a couple months to get back to you. We have a backlog. Are you still interested? And I said, your timing is exceptional. And it kind of went from there. We typically do and still do 7 interviews. So there's a screen with the recruiter. Then there's a code test. And then there's 3 other kinds of code tests. And then there's a product test, which is where you kind of show that you're not just a coder, but somebody who can think about how your code is used, how your products are developed, et cetera. And then there's a final test, which is where you meet with Joel Spolsky, and he gives you the evil eye and makes sure you're good to go. And somehow I completely made it through all of that over a period of about 6 weeks, mostly in shock and awe when I got through it. Was pretty sure I was going to fail. There were a couple rough interviews in there, but it just happened to work out. Right place, right time, right skill set, right opportunity.
At where I work, we have an interview process that involves a code test, and we've been told that the code test is complicated. I don't feel like it is, but we've been told that. Are the code tests for Stack Overflow, are they more technical, or are they more like problem-solving skills?
We definitely test for problem-solving skills. We're not trying to test for memorization or rote knowledge. We will give you all of the knowledge that you need in the test. What we really want to see is that you can write code. So typically, we'll outline a scenario. Like, we'll say, I'll give you a spoiler, one of our can you code questions, one of the first ones is FizzBuzz. So for 1 to 100, you know, if the number is divisible by 3, I'll put fizz. If it's divisible by 5, I'll put buzz. If it's divisible by both, I'll put fizzbuzz, and otherwise I'll put the number. And we'll give you pretty much all kinds of leeway. You're not working in an editor. You're working in a Google Doc shared. We're looking at it. You're looking at it. It doesn't compile. We tell you it doesn't compile. You're going to make mistakes and typos. We tell you it's fine. You're going to miss semicolons and stuff, and we don't care. We're interested in seeing your thought process and that you can logically sort of create and produce a set of code that makes sense and is efficient and works well and solves the problem. So that's typically how we approach it.
Okay. All right. I was just curious because, you know, like Microsoft and Google, they do, you know, like you got to sit down and do some complicated algorithm without fail.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that personally. I've been on both ends of it, right? I've worked jobs where I've given that test, and I've worked jobs where I've taken that test. Well, I haven't worked jobs where I've taken that test a lot of the time. I usually reject any offer I might have gotten. I don't know. I don't like mind games. I don't like interviews that are designed to make you feel stupid or to have what we like to call aha moments, right? You have to figure out the secret before you get the answer. I don't think that's relevant. I don't think most jobs involve you discovering secrets and having aha moments. I think most jobs are, let's build a website around a database. Like, who are we kidding? That's most of web development. And to that point, like, if you understand what websites are and I can test you for that, and you understand what databases are and I can test you for that, then I'm pretty sure you can also take directions. Great. You're a developer. To me, that's a much more useful measurement and way to interview and analyze people than to ask people why manhole covers are round.
Awesome.
I don't know about you, but I've never worked with a manhole cover professionally, though personally, I accidentally dropped
but
one.
How many balloons have you fit into a room?
I have one right now. It's my birthday last week. It's sitting over there. So one.
So I caught your presentation at Code Impact in Jacksonville not too long ago, where you were discussing the architecture of Stack Overflow and kind of laying out. And so that was a lot of what I got out of it, and where my interest was quite relevant to what we're dealing with on the project I'm currently working on. I wondered if you might kind of, I know there were some visuals that might not translate well in a podcast, but I wonder if you might discuss some of the architecture, some of the choices, and some of the concerns, maybe the number of environments, how code gets into production, any kind of DevOps strategies or things like that.
Sure. I'm happy to discuss any and all of that. So we have two environments, basically dev and prod. There's no QA environment. We're starting to think that maybe there should be a QA / staging environment where we kind of user test and not code test things. But right now, that's not the case. The dev environment is a couple of web servers. I think it's actually one web server per region right now, but I might be wrong. Hope I'm not wrong. I think it's two web servers in New York and two in Colorado at this time. And basically is, you know, automatically deployed to every time you commit code to our GitHub Enterprise repositories. Used to use GitLab, now use GitHub, basically a licensing thing. But automatic CI builds, so anything that you commit to a master branch is going to go out into the dev environment automatically, which is a good way to sort of smoke test what you're doing, as well as ensure that it compiles and runs, because if it doesn't, we put an embarrassing note in chat and email you and all this good stuff. Shame-driven development. It's good stuff.
So it's still primarily an MVC-based website with utilizing Dapper?
Yep, it's a heavily customized MVC implementation using Dapper and a few other libraries, some of which we've created, some of which we haven't. One of the things that we created is a person in the company named Kevin Montrose, or Monty for short, and he created something called Jill, which he claims is the fastest .NET JSON serializer ever. It's pretty darn fast. I haven't seen anything faster yet. It's because he basically wrote it in .NET, but really he just used ILOP codes. He wrote the whole thing at like really, really low level. So there's a lot of gross hacks and ugly, ugly code in it by his own admission. However, that leads to efficiencies because you don't have the compiler making guesses and you don't have optimizations and tail calls and stuff like that and branch prediction messing with you too much. So we use that for JSON serialization. We use Dapper, big fan of dog foodings. We try to use our own libraries. If we're going to advocate other people use them, then we may as well also. One interesting thing that I think a lot of people kind of get thrown for a loop on is the fact that we don't have any stored procedures at all for our SQL backend. We run all of our SQL code in the C# code. It's all strings and parameters, parameterized queries. So when I first got to this job, this is the only place I'd ever seen that, and I thought they were insane. I was like, this is ridiculous. Why are you doing this? But then I started to see the benefits. You can version your SQL with your code instead of at the stored procedure. When you're behind a load balancer and you have 10 web servers, which we do, then if you have a stored procedure, you can update it once, and then whatever code hasn't updated to match that procedure is broken now. But if your code is running the SQL, then you can actually deploy server by server and have it successfully execute without errors if you're careful in how you do your SQL and make it basically idempotent so that it can be rerun and safely and all that. So deletes are hard, but adds and net news are pretty easy. Also, like when you break your code, which none of us ever do at all at Stack Overflow except for hundreds of times a day, it comes up in the stack trace. You can actually look at the SQL that was causing the problem, whereas I'm used to, you know, executing this stored procedure failed, and then you're like, oh, okay, off I go to SQL Server Management Studio. Let's find out what happened. And then you have no guarantee that the procedure you're looking at is actually the code that's being run and all that jazz. And then the third interesting thing is for profiling. So we have Mini Profiler on our site, which allows us to take a look at the performance aspects of rendering the page, basically end-to-end, from the start of the request to the end. And it will actually show you the SQL queries because it's able to read them out of the code. And in doing that, it can also kind of highlight them and show you a breakdown of how long SQL took versus how long the .NET runtime took versus how long other aspects and things took. So that's really useful as well. On the production side, we have 10 web servers. Building to production is an automated process, but it's not automatically triggered. So even though we have a continuous integration build to dev, you can promote dev to production effectively by going into TeamCity and pressing build. We have two sites, Meta and then Stack Exchange. So we use Meta as a smoke test and kind of a QA environment of sorts. We'll deploy there first and we'll kind of watch it. We call it baking Meta. So we'll sit there and watch it bake for a couple minutes and see if there's any exceptions, see if anything exploded, see if Meta users have noticed anything going wrong or are complaining. And if not, then we'll push the second button, which is build out to the rest of the site. We do that anywhere from 3 to 15 times a day, thousands and thousands of production releases a year constantly. It's very uncommon to have more than 3 or 4 change sets in any particular production release. I'm a huge fan of that. I understand that not all companies and verticals can do that. If you have paying customers, it's very risky, right? Because you might break the code that they're paying for. If you are not set up as a company to do that kind of thing, it takes a little bit of work to create automation in TeamCity and everything else. If you don't have those skills, it's harder to do that kind of thing. It's also not something you're going to do if you're deploying two clients, right? If you're going to hand them binaries, you don't want them to have to install something new four or five times a day. They're going to go crazy. But I do prefer it where possible over that kind of iterative cycle of let's do a big release once a month or whatever that other companies that I've been at have done as well. The 10 servers are behind a load balancer. We have 2 SQL servers. One runs Stack Overflow by itself because it's a huge site. 70 million questions, including active and inactive questions and everything else. I think we're actually over 100 million now almost. And tons of data on every other site that doesn't even match up to that, which is what the other server runs. So the two SQL servers have one dedicated to Stack Overflow and one dedicated to every other site. And then the 10 web servers behind a load balancer work off that. And the whole thing is a monolith. We scale up and not out. So rather than using web services and doing the service-oriented architecture, we just have one giant monolithic code base that runs all the things, including scheduling. Scheduling is built into it. We actually have timed routes that initiate a web request against the load balancer to randomly assign one of our 10 web servers to execute the current scheduled thing, such as updating badges or updating scores and reputation, that sort of thing. And then we have a couple things like Redis and Elasticsearch sitting around to help, which are kind of ancillary services. Elasticsearch for website searching, Redis for caching. It's our caching layer. But the whole thing, we kind of consider, if we had a mantra, I would say it's that performance is a feature, and we focus on that ahead of most other things. And because of that, even though we have 10 web servers, we actually have 12 web servers, we only use 9 of them to render the site. Funny side note, we know that we can run it on one web server because we've accidentally broken everything before, so that it only ran on one web server, and it worked good-ish. But fundamentally, the web servers run very cold. They run at 9% CPU on average, and the SQL server is somewhat similar. They run at 20% because we've just fine-tuned the heck out of everything and completely butchered the MVC framework and customized the various aspects of it to our needs. And some of those requests also go back to Microsoft for what it's worth, too. We feed back a lot of features and changes to MVC to Microsoft.
And you're running on your own hardware? You're not in AWS or Azure or anything like that?
Right. So we have 2 data centers in North America that we run, our own Dell hardware out of. We do have a version of Stack Overflow called Stack Overflow Enterprise. Not sure if you've heard of it at all. It's meant for larger companies, companies that have 500 or more developers, for example. We are able to install that on site for you, or we can host that in Azure, which we have done for multiple clients now. But the main site that most programmers know and use day to day is run on our own hardware in our own data centers, because when we did the math to figure out what it would cost to run in the cloud, it was orders of magnitude much more expensive.
So how long does you said you have multiple builds per day and multiple releases. How long does a typical build release cycle take?
It takes approximately 6 to 7 minutes. So typically you'll build out to Meta, and that will be about a 3-minute compilation and deploy. Then you'll spend a minute or two taking a look to make sure everything's okay, and then another build out to production, the same 3 to 4 minute deploy. And actually, in today's meeting, we have a weekly meeting with my team. In today's meeting, we discussed a way to make it even faster by pre-caching some of our compilation. So we're going to be looking into that and hopefully bring it down to perhaps 2 minutes.
What tools are you using to check and make sure that your deployment to Meta is successful, or that the CI integration is going well?
We have basically transparency to solve that problem. So when you kick off a build, it posts something in our chat application. When the build succeeds or fails, it will post something to our chat application. People have the doctrine to ask others on the team who have commits in the pipeline if everything's okay to build before they build it out, or if they signed off for the day, because we work across the world in various time zones. I have one employee actually working in Asia right now. You know, he'll sign off his day saying, my stuff's good to build, so that people can look back at the log and know that they're okay. So we have measures and checks around that. We sometimes do break things, right? Because there's like, it won't compile errors, and then there's just logic errors where it does the wrong thing or it busts when you run it. That happens. Honestly, we give these sites out for free effectively. We're not charging you anything. You're not a paying customer in that sense. So as a result, our users tend to be a little more lenient and tolerant of the fact that we might take Stack Overflow down for 5 minutes here and there. Again, it's specific to the kind of software company that we are, because if you're a bank, that's totally unacceptable. But we're fortunate in that we are able to kind of use our users as our test environment. And so we don't have a guarantee that it's successfully rolled out and functioning correctly, but most of the time we get it pretty right. And if we don't, well, again, we have a very quick build process, less than 7 minutes to fix it.
But you typically will build to one of the web servers and then kind of rotate them in and out as needed, or so that you minimize that downtime, or downtime is more a result of something unexpected happened rather than a side effect of a build and release.
Yes, there's no downtime during the build. What happens is we talk to the load balancer and we cycle out server one. Then we deploy the code, do a couple smokescreen checks on it automatically, of course, this is all automated, and then roll it back into the production. Then we talk to the web server, pull out number two, and we do that for all nine web servers in a rolling fashion. So there's never downtime, but there is, you know, one over N degradation of service, where N is the number of servers that we run. What does break is something that runs the same way on every server. So if I write code that throws not implemented exception, and when you go to the homepage, it runs that code, then of course all the servers are going to start on fire. That's the kind of stuff we see every so often. I blew up the site 3 weeks ago. It was undone in a matter of minutes, but you know, it does happen. It's just, you'll never catch us doing it because we're so quick to both build and roll back as needed.
So since Stack Overflow is essentially an international repository of information and used across the world, are there any specific concerns when you're, you know, serving a global community, and how do you manage that with only a single data center or a single data center online at a time?
Yeah, it's a tough problem. So we have an international user base, but most of our data comes from North America, which means latency issues for some parts of the world. We mitigate that in a few ways. One is edge caching. So we use, I don't even remember who the name of the current caching provider is. It was Fastly for a while, and I forget who it is now. It's been a year or so since I dealt with that stuff. But we use a CDN provider who is able to cache a lot of the data and page outputs and information at the local edge. In other words, you know, if you're accessing us from Asia, there will be most of the data cached locally in Asia for you to access before it calls back to the primary server. Past that, just careful use of performance optimization. So the less we send over the wire, the better. We use a lot of CDN caching of libraries. So if we're using JavaScript frameworks, we're going to put them on a particular domain that we own called sstatic.net, where we put static resources, and that allows you to not have to download jQuery every page request and so on. So it is a thing. I think probably the worst hit are folks like over in Australia and whatnot. It's a little bit slower for them, but overall the performance optimization is not yet warranted like a European data center or data center out in Australia, etc.
Well, in Australia, you have to flip all the web pages upside down, right?
Yeah, exactly. And build the data center upside down too. It's one thing is, a lot of people don't know about this, but all modern web browsers support something called client timings, and you can actually set a header that will tell the web browser to send you performance information about the request. And it's sort of a standardized format, and we use that. And so we collect client timings constantly and use those to profile how slow we are across various parts of the world. It's a very useful and effective thing to figure out how your application is performing. Since it's very hard yourself being near your data center to test what it's like from Australia, what it's like from Venezuela, et cetera, et cetera.
Since you're collecting all this information about performance, do you use any specific tools to help you digest that information or understand the data that you're collecting?
Yeah, one tool is built in-house, of course, and it's called Observer. There's a gentleman on my team named Nick Craver, who's somewhat known in the community. He has built an application over the years called Observer, which is a great kind of plug-and-play central brain for your environment. So in production, we have it hooked into our web servers, our SQL servers, our Redis servers and Elasticsearch servers, pretty much everything, and it will report on performance numbers as well as exceptions. It'll keep a rolling log, and it'll even highlight and color code different parts of the exception, and it will handle task parallel exceptions as well, which is nice for the async features of .NET. For other stuff, we have an application also built internally called Boson. So Boson is a throwback to the piratey term, I guess, and what it does is it effectively monitors stats in a very boring way. So you basically can call it to Boson from a client library saying, this stat key, this value. And what it does is it establishes standard deviations of normal. And if any of those statistics, once they start reporting, go out of normal, which you can override and define yourself or it'll figure it out for you, then it can send an alert to our site reliability team that may be on call to jump in and take a look and page the appropriate person or fix the thing or turn off the feature. So that's one way as well.
Now, one thing you had mentioned in Jacksonville was something that Stack Overflow will be launching towards the end of the year.
Yeah, it's called Channels. It's an interesting take on the existing Stack Overflow question and answer platform that I'm actually really excited about. One of the biggest questions that I get at Stack Overflow and when I go to speaking engagements such as Code Impact a month ago is, how do you make money? Right? We're not very intrusive. We don't like paywall our site. We don't throw a ton of ads at you. And in fact, if you sign up for an account and participate after a couple hundred reps, you stop seeing most ads entirely. So there's some revenue there, but there's not a ton of revenue there. Our major platform is what we call Talent, which is a combination of job listings and employers being able to access profiles, searchable profiles of users. To be clear, you have to opt into that. We're not just going to start scraping your data when you sign up and show you to employers. But if you decide to create what's called a developer story and a profile around that, then we will be able to match you with employers. One thing that's different there is that we use a fair bit of machine learning. We have very, very brilliant data scientists on our team, including Julia and Dave. They're really, really good. Best I've ever worked with. And they use a learning model to basically match you effectively with jobs. It's kind of spooky. In some ways, we know more about you than you might know about you. We can, if you have an account, we can keep track of what IP addresses you access us from and where, and we'll automatically discern, okay, you're a full stack developer because you're going to questions about both front end, back end database technologies on the regular. And you're going from one IP address known to be corporate in the daytime from 9 to 5, but at night, you're coming from this other IP address. It's probably your home address. And you're looking up different tech stacks. So we know now that you're a daytime .NET developer with a Java nighttime interest. And then from that, we can cross-reference data and say, you're probably making X dollars a year. And then we show you jobs that make X plus 10%. And that'll be, and in your area. Or if we know you're not remote because you have two IP addresses, more likely you're not remote, we'll offer you remote jobs, that sort of thing. So it's actually kind of creepy how good it is. I'm really impressed by it. But the problem with this interesting model is that it doesn't allow us to focus on the core Q&A platform. We, I would have to honestly say, have kind of neglected it over the last year or so. Our meta users have pointed that out. They're correct. We've basically, it's not malicious. We've just deprioritized it to try and approach revenue more directly with jobs and talent. But Channels is an interesting solution to both. Channels effectively pairs the Q&A platform that you know and love with a revenue stream, which gives us a totally justifiable excuse to bang on and develop the Q&A platform further. So it's going to work in a way where, as an organization, so that could be a company or a set of hobbyists or a coding group or camp, you can create a channel which allows you to question and answer privately on any topic you like with your own private tags. So you can create a section of the site that is safe and secure from the public domain and allows you to store information that's relevant only to your particular organization. There might be very specific verticals that the general population isn't going to be aware of. Like, in our internal app, when I do this, this happens. Like, nobody's going to take that question. It's going to get closed. It's not constructive or too specific. But if you put that in your channel, one of your coworkers can answer it and say, oh yeah, just do this to fix it. And then there are some options to switch very interestingly between the channel's view and the public view, and even potentially merge the views together so that you could see a set of questions from both at the same time. So that's a product that we're going to eventually charge for. I think the current strategy is freemium, so up to so many users, kind of like Slack, it's not going to cost anything. And then if you get bigger and need more, then we'll start to bill you either by user or flat rate. I'm very excited about it because it's solving a big problem that we see. It's testing really well. We have a really great user experience person named Christina, and she's been testing it with people, not randomly, but selected carefully in the public and not biased, like not just ourselves and our family who say it's great, but random people and developers and power users and new users alike. And they're all very excited by the prospect of a less intimidating first interaction with Stack Overflow, but also a reason and justification to use it in the workplace even more. Being able to keep your knowledge all in one place, your public knowledge and your domain-specific knowledge. So we're really excited about that.
Very cool.
Right on. And that'll launch. We're going to hopefully have an internal launch this week. We're hoping to roll it out to beta users the next month, and then we're hoping to have it in public, hopefully before the end of the year, if not very early next year. So that's something that you'll see and hear about very soon, kind of a sneak peek, but I'm very excited about it.
Great. All right, David. Well, did you have any other upcoming engagements or any speaking opportunities that you're excited about?
I'm mostly done through the year. I had a pretty busy 2017, personal and professional travel, but also speaking engagements, basically back-to-back from May through September. So now, for the last quarter of the year, I'm planning to kind of take it easy, stay at home for a little while. Although I'm failing at that, I'll be in Detroit this weekend, but that's personal, not speaking. But through Christmas, probably nothing. Coming up next year, who knows? We'll see what I'm invited to or what I can get approved to go to or have submissions, you know, approved at and go from there.
Well, great. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been really fun.
That was David Haney. David works at Stack Overflow as an engineering manager. He's a craft beer enthusiast and loves supporting local breweries. David enjoys both retro and modern video games, tabletop board gaming, and watching movies in old school one screen theaters with his lovely wife. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
This has been the Six Figure Developer Podcast. I am John Calloway.
And I'm Clayton Hunt. We'll be right back.